Early in her medical career, Dr. Olivia Ong decided that instead of becoming a neurosurgeon, she'd go into rehabilitation medicine. Little could she know how important that field of work would be to her, not just as a doctor, but also as a patient. Because one otherwise ordinary work day, when a driver with dementia in the hospital parking lot accidentally hit the accelerator instead of the brake, Olivia was hit by a car and left with a serious spinal injury. She was told she would never walk again. Olivia's written about her rehabilitation journey back to becoming a rehabilitation and pain doctor in her memoir, Back on My Feet. That journey, she says, wasn't just a physical recovery, but a total mental, emotional, and spiritual transformation. Dr. Olivia Ong, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thanks for having me, Julian.
Let's talk about your upbringing. You say that you were different from the stereotypical Asian kids who ended up becoming high achievers because their parents put a lot of pressure on them. Tell us about you and your parents.
Yeah, so my parents and I have quite a strong relationship. In fact, they didn't force me to do medicine at all. So they don't fit in like the other stereotypical Asian parents who do force their kids to either do medicine, law, or accountant, or engineering, depending on which Asian country you come from. And in fact, my mom was so concerned whether I'll get married if I ended up doing medicine. So that was quite funny.
So you weren't free of parental pressures?
No, not really. They just wanted me to do the best I can. I think my dad had that expectation a little bit, but not so much my mom, because my dad wanted to be a doctor back in his time in the 70s. But unfortunately, he had to kind of help out with the family business, the small business banking. So he couldn't do medicine at all. So I think he kind of indirectly wanted me to be a doctor, but he was okay to let me pursue whatever I wanted, really.
But we shouldn't mislead people by thinking that that meant that you did not have a lot of pressure on you to perform academically. Where did that pressure come from, Olivia?
Well, that pressure came from just being in Singapore as well. For the audience out there, Singapore is a country in Southeast Asia that is very highly focused on academic studies in children's education. So that's the kind of environment I grew up in. And it was school pressure, teachers pressure us, and then ultimately, I think the environment affected who I was, and I started putting a lot of pressure on myself. And interestingly, I mean, we're talking about the 90s, late 90s. We had shows like ER, if you remember Noah Wiley and George Clooney and all these people. ER was quite inspiring for me. I was only a teenager when that show came on, and every time I hear the theme song, I'll get really excited. That would actually be my theme song, I guess, to inspire me to kind of focus on medicine. And there was a turning point, I guess, sometime in high school, probably about like equivalent year 11, year 12 in Singapore, where I started doing a lot of volunteer work to help intellectually disabled and elderly people. I'll visit nursing homes, the homes for those disadvantaged people, and just, you know, either read books to them or feed them. And I just feel like that was my purpose in medicine, was to just treat other people like fellow human beings. And that was my higher purpose. So I think that was my turning point, because before then I was just like so focused on my studies, and any spare time that I had, I will listen to a lot of music just to kind of calm my nervous system down. I mean, in my time, there was like Spice Girls and, you know, we had New Kids on the Block. If you remember the 90s, it was these people. Michael Jackson was really popular as well. Yeah, so those songs kept me going in the periods where I wasn't studying. But as I said, in the later high school years, there was a kind of a certainty or surety that medicine was probably the right area for me to kind of work towards, because it will help me fulfill my dream of helping people feel human again and help them feel seen and heard. And that was kind of the turning point, yeah.
And you fulfilled that dream, and it was pursuing medicine that brought you to Australia, and you graduated, started working in Australian hospitals. And like most doctors, Olivia, I think it's fair to say you found your early medical career grueling. You describe it as a combination of an unforgiving system and your own unforgiving self. Could you speak a little about that?
Working in the medical environment, precision is very highly valued. I mean, obviously, if doctors make mistakes, you know, we can potentially cause the death of our patients. So from a very young age, I guess since medical school, we were thrown into the hospital system and kind of indoctrinated, I don't know whether that's the right word, indoctrinated to think that we were lone rangers, and if we ask for help, it will mean that we are weak. So we kind of keep to ourselves a lot. And it's highly competitive, of course. And that's even more so when I graduated from medical school. Training positions were quite limited. And I think perfectionism was something I grew up with. And that tendency to kind of make the teachers happy, we call it people pleasing or whatever term you want to call it. And when I don't fulfill to the teacher's expectations or my own expectations, I will start to berate myself, beat myself up. So that kind of behavior kind of started since I was a kid. But at that time, I wasn't aware that I was doing it. I thought, you know, that's like normal voice. It's only obviously later on in my journey to learn to walk again when I realized that was not a good voice at all. But that voice continued throughout my junior medical doctor days. I remember if I make a little mistake, I will freak out and I will double check the doses of drugs over and over again. And if I make a little mistake, I will start to probably silently beat myself up before my boss started, you know, why did you make this mistake? How can you do this? And there's a lot of that kind of culture, a lot of not very supportive culture in medicine, lots of blaming.
But for all those pressures, you were succeeding, you were advancing in your chosen career. But then, of course, Olivia, everything changed. And you've chosen, unsurprisingly, 2008, the year of your accident, as the year that made you. The beginning of your book, Back on My Feet, has an incredibly captivating start in the prologue, which you've called self-triage. I wonder if you could give us a bit of a glimpse of the self-triage that you performed on yourself when the accident happened, and I suppose what that says about you as a person as well.
Yeah, I think obviously the accident was very unexpected, because in the moment I was just chatting to my colleague, and in an instant some out-of-control car just hit us. And I found myself just on the ground, just barely grasping about what has happened. So I think it was probably instinctual to just go into the doctor mode, because when I triaged, I was very happy to know that I was alive. I think I was already grateful to know I wasn't dead. Like, you know, there's something about dying early and not fulfilling your purpose in life, that kind of thing. I watched too many Hollywood movies, but that was a big, big thing for me. Like, I just wanted to leave my legacy and do things I love before I die, kind of thing. And that moment, I was grateful I didn't die, and I started going to doctor mode, because I think it was a way for my nervous system and my brain as well to just cope with the shock of everything else. And I started triaging very quickly, because I learned all those skills when I was doing a emergency medicine rotation way back in medical school. Even as an intern, I was doing, you know, two emergency medicine terms, so I know how to triage very quickly. So I started obviously using my rehabilitation medicine knowledge, triage myself. Like, I could move my arms and I go, hey, I'm not quadriplegic and all this. And I could think, I didn't have a head injury. And then when I started to realize I couldn't move or feel my legs, and then I started freaking out, going, oh, yeah, this is spinal cord injury. I just learned about this a few months ago for my entrance exam. And deep down, I knew, oh gosh, this is going to be hard to come back from. But yeah, I will say that that kind of triaging was a self-defense mechanism to cope with the trauma, the physical and mental, emotional trauma that I just went through in like a split second.
And really, it was responding to something that was going to just change all aspects of your life. We haven't mentioned the fact that before then you got married, you were on a pathway to a successful career, a family life that you dreamt of, and all of a sudden everything was different. It was painful, I assume, in every possible sense. Looking back on the early days of your treatment and recovery, what got you through it, Olivia?
I would say what got me through it was the support of my husband, John. I think just him being by my side gave me a lot of assurance. My close friends and family, I was really grateful for that. And yeah, and the colleagues and friends that came out of nowhere, well, not saying came out of nowhere, they've been there, but they came out and stepped up and helped out. And some didn't and disappeared, which is very sad, but it's kind of revealing who are your true friends. And what also got me through was music as well. Music played a huge part in recovery in the early days. And I'll say my faith, you know, just believing that if I believe in something small, the big will come. I think that will be my main thing that got me through. my spinal cord injury is incomplete. So complete's when the spinal cord is like severed, whereas mine is partially smashed, but there's still parts of it that's still okay and intact. So deep down, I knew that I was an incomplete injury and I need to hold on to that little bit of hope. It's not false hope because there is some hope there.
On The Year That Made Me, we're speaking with Dr. Olivia Ong, whose new memoir is Back on My Feet. And Olivia, although you were told that you wouldn't walk again, you did manage to get to the point where you are able to walk these days and also to move back into your career and to starting a family and the full and wonderful life that you describe in the book. You also write very honestly and perceptively, I think, about the impact of your injury on your marriage, on the way that you and John were in some ways going through the same journey, but in some ways such different journeys, and the stresses that that created, but that you were able to pull through from. Could you speak a little about that?
Yeah. When I had my injury, we were just 2 years out. We were newlyweds, if you can call it that. We kind of knew each other, but not very well. And I think what I was grateful for was the fact that he stood by me, and we obviously spent a lot of time together, not by choice, but because he became my carer. And when I was discharged from the hospital, he was it. And, you know, spinal cord injury is messy. It's a hot mess. And things happen like bowel and bladder accidents, which, you know, people don't talk about. And, you know, I wasn't able to clean up my own mess. And guess who has to clean it up? It's John. And then it made me realize what kind of man he was. So I think I'm very appreciative of him staying by me. And also, he's someone who doesn't talk very much, but takes action. He's a very quiet man. So the little things he does for me, like he will just send me to physio back and forth, or to the doctors back and forth, driving me around. Because at that time, I couldn't drive as yet, because obviously I'm paralyzed from the waist down with hardly any movement in my right leg, although my left leg did have some movement. So I needed a lot of help from him. As the journey to walk again continued, we got to spend more time together. And in America, we got to spend even more time together. And that was the turning point of our marriage, when we traveled. I think traveling, there's something about travel and sense of awe and wonder that really brings people together. And it brought John and I together. Yeah, and I think our marriage grew stronger that way, because we saw the lowest of both of us, me going through my grief and sadness and John just going through his own grief and loss of, you know, of me, like the wife that was able-bodied and now she's not, and relying on him 100%. So I will say that the travel and the time we had at Project Walk in America brought us together, and we had friends in America that were going through similar things.
Yeah, tell us about Project Walk.
Yeah, Project Walk is an amazing place. I was so grateful that YouTube was invented in 2008. I'm so grateful, because YouTube videos got me through in those darkest days in the rehab ward. I was there for 4 months, and every night I will search people walking again after spinal cord injury. That was like every night was the same thing, and YouTube videos will pop up from the US, and it's always about Project Walk. Project Walk clients were putting out videos of them walking again with their trainers, and I was fascinated. I went, this is not like what I'm going through in the rehab ward I'm in. We don't even talk about walking. In fact, it was discouraged. We were told to adjust to our wheelchair and get on with it, and I refused to buy that, because I wanted to give myself a chance and give myself a good go. And those YouTube videos kept me going, even though when I returned back to part-time work in 2009, I mean, when I finished work, I will still watch those YouTube videos. And eventually one day in December 2009, I was watching a Channel 7 documentary called Sunday Night. And one of the people that I went to the hospital rehab ward with, Michael, he was there. He was there, a full-on documentary about him in Project Walk. And I went, oh, wow, if he can do that, I want to do that too. Like, because they showed him like walking with a frame and everything. I went, oh yeah, I am going to California. And then and there, we just did that. I emailed Project Walk. I got a spot. We flew there a few months later when I finished up my part-time work in the hospital that I was rotated to. That was about February 2009. And we never turned back since. Because the moment we stepped into Project Walk, high vibe, you know, it's America. Well, you can't expect anything less. It's high vibe, pumping hip-hop music. Everyone was pumped. Clients were pumped. Trainers were pumped. And everyone was not in their wheelchair. Everyone was, either standing up or walking or doing exercises out of the chair. And I'm going, this is where I need to be. And then that's when I decided I belong here for now, because I didn't feel a sense of belonging since my injury up until that point. I just felt I didn't fit in with the normal society because everyone's able-bodied. And I had a lot of shame and guilt about myself and very low self-esteem. I think America brought me back. Yeah.
Another significant part of your self-identity and your self-esteem was working as a doctor. And again, you write about the impact of getting a call from Dr. Chow, and even just the presumption or the openness to you returning to work was significant to you. And you also wrote about what you described as his attention to the subtle yet profound details of workplace dignity. Could you speak about that a little?
Yeah, so I'm very grateful that Dr. Cho was there at that point in my life, because I remember that I got that job a few months before my accident. Obviously, I didn't expect to have the accident. And I remember when I was home from hospital about a few months in at my service apartment while waiting for my actual home to be modified, which took about a year to be modified. And Dr. Chu just rang me one day and said, hey, would you like to work in that role that was given to you before the injury? We could make it work for you. I think when he said that, that was music to my ears, because by that point, I felt like I'll never, ever get back to medicine. And I think in hospital, in those early days, that was my main thing. Like, what if I can't do what I love? Like, medicine was my love and my passion. And if I can't do it, what good am I? Like, who is Dr. Ong? It was an identity crisis, I think. And when he offered to help, somehow to help me return back to work, I was very grateful. So what he did was such a smooth process where he and another doctor, Dr. Hunter, made sure that I was able to transition back to work pretty smoothly. Not only that, we also had an automatic door installed to the doctor's office. So every time I will wheel up to it, it will just automatically open. Like, these are things that I took for granted before my accident, because I was very, very fit. I would climb up and down stairs to go to different wards. I mean, I was only 28, so maybe I was very fit then. I was doing all that stuff. But a lot of things we took for granted. And once we lose that ability to be able to walk anymore, then I realized, oh my gosh, I have taken so many things for granted, not just walking. So I started paying a lot of attention to accessibility in terms of like the tone of people's voice. You know, I started to look at nonverbal things, like what did that actually mean? But overall, I think, yeah, Dr. Chu really helped me to find my way back to rehab medicine. And I'm very grateful because I was able to continue that after America.
Olivia, what did you learn about the way doctors relate to patients from being thrust so dramatically and painfully into the role of patient?
I just recall before my accident, I was not very patient with my patients. Because I have so much things to do as a junior doctor. I was often impatient with them and didn't wait for them to finish, and I just wanted to get on with it. But throughout my experience as a patient, it was really eye-opening. It's even scary for a medical practitioner like me to be a patient in the hospital. The uncertainty, the fear, the helplessness, the hopelessness, I just can't imagine what it's like for patients who are there for the first time, thrown in that kind of environment. It just made me realize how brave and courageous my patients are, and I cannot be so impatient like that. And doctors, sometimes, unfortunately, we will not remember the full name of the patient. We'll say bed numbers. It's just not, we don't treat them as humans, yeah? But throughout my experience, yeah, I just learned how to be a human being to other humans. I think that was the main thing of what I got out of this whole experience. What I think we lack in hospital systems will be not allowing our patients to grieve about their diagnosis. The fact that they'll probably have suffered from an identity loss. I wish we can create more space and capacity to allow that to happen and support them through it. I think this is what's needed in the hospital system. We need to be human.
What have you learned about certainty and uncertainty?
As a control freak, before my accident, I was like a control freak, and certainty was something I hung on to. But living through a spinal cord injury where every day is not certain eventually leads to some kind of acceptance, some kind of knowing that uncertainty may not be a bad idea, because curiosity will take over and then we ask ourselves, let's just find out what happens, see? I mean, that's the kind of mindset I brought to America, because I didn't know what California was. I mean, I went to Disneyland in 1995. And that was my only memory of America. And I went, let's just find out what California holds. And boy, it blew my mind. It just changed my life. I mean, living in Carlsbad, beautiful place in the world near San Diego, the weather is perfect. I mean, I live in Melbourne, so it's like cold, hot. You know? But it's so consistent in Carlsbad and San Diego. Yeah, it's beaches, sunsets, cocktails. Okay, maybe too many cocktails there. But, you know, like just hanging out with trainers and fellow clients, it allowed me to just take the time to rest and slow down before you speed up type of thing. I really like that. And I miss that. That's why I wrote the book, actually. It's just, I miss California and I miss that lifestyle with my friends over there.
How has what you've gone through changed your identity as a doctor and your approach to your work now?
I think in terms of identity, I tend to wear many hats these days because I'm a mom of two. Still practice full-time as a pain physician and I do a lot of speaking and writing. And I think it's easy to feel overwhelming if you try to do all the things at one time. But I learned this kind of exercise called the successful identity, where if I wear, let's say if I'm going to, you know, like if I'm picking up my son from cello class later and spend time with him, I'm going to wear the successful mom identity hat and I'm going to be the best mom I can be for that period with my son. And similarly, if I'm working in hospital and seeing patients, at that moment, it's not the best wife, best mom. I'm going to be the best doctor I can. And I think if we do adopt that, we will feel less burnt out and less overwhelmed. And that's how I've kind of worked through identities, because I went through a huge identity crisis, if you can imagine, Julian, with the spinal cord injury and all. And then when I returned back to Melbourne to resume my medical career, it was another whole identity shift again. But over the years, I realized as I grew older and wiser, hopefully, that having this successful identity thing, adopting it just makes me less stressed, less overwhelmed with things, and just be able to enjoy the present. So I do enjoy doing well at one particular identity at the time and then wearing many hats that way.
You describe the medicine that you practice now as heart-centered medicine and that it enables you to meet your patients where they are. You say that adopting that approach has had ripple effects. What are those ripple effects?
These days, I work in the area of pain medicine. And I think with pain medicine, we are allocated about 60 minutes to see a patient. It's allowing the patients to tell their story from beginning to end. And I think heart-centered means that just seeing them and hearing them where they're at that present moment, allowing them to speak and tell their story so that they feel seen, heard, and able to express themselves. So I think that is heart-centered, where we feel some kind of connection. In other words, our nervous systems are actually like talking to each other. Our nervous systems kind of regulating with each other. And, you know, if I have a calm nervous system, they will have a calm nervous system and that kind of thing. So that's one bit. And the other bit will be, because of my journey to walk again, I learned how to be kinder to myself. I learned how to hear my own friendly voice, not the harsh critical voice. And that's something that I will always teach my patients as well, like just to be kinder to themselves. Because a lot of them, by the time they come to see me, they're beating themselves up left, right, center, and they feel very devastated and they're feeling helpless and hopeless. And I know what it was like to be feeling like that. So I think learning to have self-compassion towards themselves, that's also heart-centered medicine. So connection and self-compassion, these are the important parts of heart-centered medicine. And if I could write a script for all my patients, I will write self-compassion on that script and give it to them.
Dr. Olivia Ong, it's been fantastic speaking with you on The Year That Made Me. Congratulations on your recovery and the great achievement of the new memoir, which is Back on My Feet, From Doctor to Patient. And as the cover rightly says, it is a moving and inspirational memoir of traumatic injury, faith, and hope. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Julian.
And we know how important music is to you, Olivia. So it's going to be hard for you to narrow down your music choice, I realise, but I'm sure you've gone through some sort of reformed perfectionist process to work out what we're going to hear. Now, what have you chosen for us, Olivia, and why?
I chose Miley Cyrus' The Climb. This song was really a big hit when I had my spinal cord injury. And the lyrics is very meaningful because it talks about, it's not how fast you get there, it's about the journey kind of thing. And it's about inner resilience. It's about that resilience doesn't have to be loud and bold. It can be just quiet, just showing up every day for therapy sessions. And that song kind of depicts all that. I mean, I know it's from Hannah Montana movie. I get it. But this is a beautiful song from Miley Cyrus. I really, when I'm down in the dumps in those early days, this is a song that will get me through, definitely.
And here it is, Miley Cyrus, The Climb. And Olivia, thank you once again.
Thank you.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.